Hey everybody, this is the Ludwig von Mises Institute, the Mises Academy, and the course is, as you know, World War I, Crucible of the Age of Statism. And I am Hunt Tooley, and this is the last session of our course. Christmas, as I understand it, is approaching, and if we hold up for another hour and a half or so, then we will have outdone World War I statesmen and generals because we will have it done by Christmas. So tonight, conclusions, the peace, the costs, the future, etc. And let's plunge right in to our topic. So the way I'd like to do this, and it's hard to figure this one out. This is a tough lecture because there's so many ways you can go. And I will have to say that there's a lot here that that we just haven't, we haven't really, we don't really have time, I should say, to cover, especially all the post-war things. It's almost like another course. Maybe I'll talk to Danny about this, and we'll just do a follow-up course sometime soon on the interwar period and the peacemaking and all that, because it's a whole other topic, and it's so much connected with this one that it would go well together. So I want to talk a lot about Europe at the end of the war and just after, but I want to explore some little nooks and crannies that we don't usually talk about, and maybe we'll ignore a little bit about. It's not going to be an hour's worth of war guilt clause or anything like that, although we certainly will mention that. And one thing that we need to say at the outset is that at the war's end, Europe was extremely hungry. Germany was hungry. Nearly 700,000 had died there, but other countries were hungry too. It was and if we ask why, all we have to understand is the basic Misesian insight that war is destructive and destroys things and lowers the efficiency of a society, lowers the civilization of a society, and this great war lowered it, all those things greatly, including the food, the nutritional aspects of Europe. So Europe is whatever else we say today, think in the background, and they're hungry. So let's just go right on to the collapse of the Central Powers. And these are not, unlike most of the pictures we've had for this course, these are not actually dead bodies. These are sleeping POWs in a POW compound. They're Germans, and I like this picture for my title because they have just collapsed there. And that's a pile of lumber. It looks like, some 2x4s and other kinds of lumber. And if you can find a pile of lumber soft, then I think it really does mean that you're worn out. If that's your bed, then you're pretty close to collapse for sure. So prisoners, of course, they had good reason to be tired, considering what a POW had to endure in World War I. But if you take a look at the other pictures too, you see some signs of collapse. One measure is that these are German soldiers. Look at these kids. Now, the malnutrition is going to lower the sort of maturity level and make onset of puberty come late and so forth and so on. But these are just kids. This is an American chaplain talking to a German soldier of the Great War on the right. And then the child on the left is also a child fully in the army and in the military. So if Germany is drawing on these kinds of resources and hollowing out its human resources in this vast total war way, then something has to give pretty soon. Of course, the other powers were also whittling away at their own resources as well. What happens in the last stages of the war, and I mentioned it last week, is the 100 Days Battle, masterminded by a general or field marshal now, Field Marshal Haig, who became the commander-in-chief of the Western Front. with Joffre as the overarching head of Allied planning. And what Haig had in mind was just to was the same kind of grinding attack that he had become famous for. Remember, he started out as a breakthrough general, a cavalry general who wanted to get to the green fields beyond, and he developed into a solid hit that line kind of a general. In a way, it's a sort of General Grant approach at last. He hits everybody just as with everybody he's got, he hits the line as hard as he can. And so from Ypres to the Somme Valley, to the Champagne, to the Argonne Wood, where the Americans take over, and the very tail end of the line where the French are, everybody's attacking for the last 100 days of the war. And so it is certainly a full court press. And in this sense, the 100 days battle won the war. It's hard to see how the Allies, with the American resources coming into the war, wouldn't have won it overwhelmingly anyway. But it is true that at least the strategy proved sound. Here are Canadians advancing, and look, they're not advancing across a no man's land type situation. They're just walking along across the ground as the Germans are withdrawn. Now the Germans fight a rearguard action, and the war stops before the Lions ever got to Germany. So in terms of the Western Front, the Western Front was still in France and still in Belgium when the war ended on November 11th. So the 100 Days Battle didn't push the Germans out of France. It just wore the Germans out. And also, as we shall see, the German leadership also failed during this whole period. So things begin to collapse with the Central Powers. The Ottoman Empire surrendered first via the armistice of Mudros in October 1918. Constantinople was occupied. The empire was partitioned. Piecemeal. Parts of the empire, of the Ottoman Empire, had been surrendering before. Jerusalem in 1917, you see this ragtag moment of the surrender. The Arab army of Lawrence and the others enters Damascus on October 1st. Allenby arrives shortly thereafter. And so the powers are kind of closing in on the Ottomans, and they surrender on the Greek island of Mudros and create an armistice, which is to lead to a treaty in the future. And that's the pattern for all these things. So the armistice, technically speaking, an armistice is just a ceasefire. But each of the ceasefires negotiated with the Central Powers were negotiated in such a way that they were surrenders as well. We'll talk about that technicality in just a moment. So Germany's at the end, but now there I hesitated to say that Germany collapsed completely, because for one thing, the front didn't collapse. The soldiers they never engaged in Russian-style mutinies or running from the lines. The soldiers stayed in the front lines, and the only way that they stopped manning the trenches, there was no French-style failure to attack or anything. The only way they stopped manning those trenches was for the Germans to surrender on November 11th. But the 100 Days Battle is certainly an attritional battle, and the Germans were running short on supplies and food and lubricants and parts for guns and so forth. But what also happened is that Ludendorff, who is taking on more and more of the responsibilities of the war through 1916, when he and Hindenburg came to take over and establish this kind of military dictatorship that we've talked about. Things are wearing him down. I mean, he's, as we know from leadership in this modern world of the total state, where the person in charge of this huge state has so many micromanagement type decisions to make, that they all grow old. I mean, it used to be just sort of war presidents aged in office, but now all presidents age in office because these tremendous every minute of a crisis kind of decisions all come to their shoulders. And Ludendorff was the one in the hot seat in this military dictatorship. It's also true that his stepson was killed in the summer of 1918, and this impacted him quite severely. His wife was distraught, and he himself oddly took off a few days from staff work to go hunt for the possible sites where his son might have crashed. So he's a person who is in fact losing control. I don't believe I've said this before, but one of my colleagues at Austin College is a psychologist, and when I took him Ludendorff's picture, and he doesn't really know much about history, but when I was writing the book, I took Howard a photograph like this or a different one of Ludendorff, and I said, well, what would you make of a person if this person, he's a clinical psychologist as well as a professor, and I said, what would you make of a person like this who, if you walk into your office? And he looked at the photograph for a minute. He said, well, this is a person who needs to be in control, who likes to be in control, and it's a person who is very, very tightly wound on the verge of some kind of neurosis or neurotic event, and because this person is unable to maintain control, there are too many things going on. Now, he may have guessed that by the uniform, but I gave him no context whatsoever, so I thought, wow, Howard Starr, you're a wizard. So, because that was about the situation. And indeed, Ludendorff went back to the great general staff and proceeded from looking for his stepson and proceeded to have a genuine mental event. In other words, he broke down, he started weeping during these meetings. He would send everybody out of the meeting, and it just broke down. It was at this time, then in August 1918, that he started calling a number of different days the Black Day of the German Army, and he started sending almost hysterical messages to the cabinet. Now, remember, it's a military dictatorship, which had practically taken away the responsibilities of the civilian cabinet, but the civilian cabinet still operated and went about its daily task as if they were really the government of the country. But they really had no responsibility. That cabinet might have negotiated earlier when the Germans were in a strong position. That cabinet might have negotiated at the height of the spring offensive when Haig thought that he was being pushed off into the sea. But Ludendorff had held firm that there would be no surrender. And so now that he's losing, then he loses it and sends these hysterical messages. Then he kind of gathers himself up in September. He's a little bit more himself, and he tells the government. Then he reverses his decision. No, we don't need to surrender yet, but we need to make these changes at home. And then he switches back. So Ludendorff's state is pretty important. And so it's very interesting that this, for all the emphasis put, the preparation for this war, the years of planning, the Schlieffen Plan, and the extent to which this war determines the future of the modern world, that it starts with the nervous breakdown of Moltke in the midst of the Schlieffen Battle of 1914, and it ends with Ludendorff's breakdown at the during the Battle of the Hundred Days. It's really remarkable. So he's hysterically calling for an armistice, and the civilian government begins to gather power to itself as Ludendorff just simply hands the power back to them. And the civilians decided that the only chance was, boy, did they dial the wrong number. Their only chance was Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points. Because he said the peace of justice, he said war should be negotiated on the basis of self-determination. They knew he called himself a Democrat and all that. So they said, we need to get a government that can talk to Wilson. Therefore, they they went to an opposition person, a South German liberal, a prince in one of the South German states named Prince Maximilian, or Prince Max. He was very liberal, so he went by Max. But from this German state of Baden. And he was a bona fide German liberal. South Germany is more famous for its kind of liberal sentiment with a small L, I mean, in that way than other parts of Germany. And Prince Max put together a cabinet of people who were constitutional law professors and attorneys and people who were bona fide civilians who hoped they could end the war by talking to Wilson, by making overtures to the Allies and saying, okay, well, we've reformed and we're no longer the kind of military dictatorship that's hated. They thought that that the previous regime was politically loaded. So they sent an armistice commission to the Allies, who agreed to negotiate at the Belgian watering hole Spa. And that armistice commission negotiated through October, or the end of October and into November, and eventually agreed to the armistice, which in German, of course, is called Waffenstillstand, and that means, you know, the setting quiet of weapons. In other words, it's just a ceasefire. That's all it means. But in fact, what this armistice commission had negotiated in the way of, well, we'll give you a ceasefire if you Germans give up all your weapons and if you give up all your tanks and if you give up your artillery pieces. And they agreed to that under the urging, once again, of Ludendorff and the generals. And so I think they negotiated badly at Spa, and the German government did. So that's what's happening up to October. But when it came to be known, there were rumors that there would be a surrender. And at that point, the admirals who had been sitting in the ports in North Germany ever since the Battle of Jutland in 1916, they ordered the German fleet to sea for a grand, climactic, Armageddon-like, social Darwinist, Wagnerian going down in defeat against the British Navy. Well, the troops who had the sailors who had survived the war, unlike their cousins in the on the land, they just wouldn't have any of it. And there was an outbreak of mutiny in the city of Kiel, in the port of Kiel, among the sailors, who started immediately sailors' councils. And now remember, the word Soviet meant was the Russian word for council. So these were sailors who had sat in port, done some reading and followed the news, and also been persuaded by the council mentality. So they made sailors' councils, and then the local barracks where there were also soldiers, they made soldiers' councils and justified the German admirals. That spread from port to port to port, and then from city to city, so that within a few days, all of Germany was having council movements or Soviets set up in each place. In the midst of this, on November 9th, Prince Max just called the socialist leaders. I mean, he reasoned with these crowds in the street, with council movements trying to take over the government, there is no way that a liberal, bourgeois, middle-of-the-road, middle-class-type government can ride this whirlwind. Therefore, we'll turn to the mainstream SPD, Social Democratic Party politicians, who you'll remember had voted for the war credits, had been good patriots through the war, had shown that they were supporters, basically, of the governmental structure and so forth. And so he turns to these characters. There's Philipp Scheidemann on the left in that picture, and then Friedrich Ebert on the right. Meanwhile, though, the radical left took advantage of the council movement, sometimes working with it, sometimes against it, to try to foment a revolution in the streets. And so they founded, these were all people, Karl Liebknecht, Rosa Luxemburg, and a number of others who had been in contact with the Russians all along. I mean, they were part of the International with Lenin, knew him very well, knew all about his Marxism-Leninism, about Bolshevism, and hoped to bring that to pass in Germany. And so Liebknecht, and you see his picture, his photograph on the upper right of that slide, he's calling for a real red revolution. And by the way, I made that photograph as red as I could. It's probably too small to see the flag that the guy on the in the car is holding out, but it really was a red flag. I mean, this was an attempted communist uprising, but in the end, fairly small, and in the end, not very well supported by the council movement, because all the soldiers were coming back, and they formed soldiers' councils and factory councils and whatnot, and a lot of these folks just didn't want to see a Bolshevik revolution. So Liebknecht and his group, by the way, called the Spartacus League, with the implication that they were slaves, throwing off their chains, just like Spartacus. So fighting broke out, confused fighting in the streets between the factions. The more soldiers made their way home, the more there got to be volunteer Freikorps or Freiwilligenkorps organizations that consisted of these soldiers returning from the front, whose attitude was, well, I don't want to see my country. I've fought for my country all this time and made all these sacrifices, and I don't want to come back and see these socialists make a communist paradise out of it. So there was fighting in the streets, very brutal fighting, and remember, nearly all these people knew how to fight very well. I mean, everybody had some connection to the army. So there was a lot of violence there. Well, to make a long story short, in this German Revolution, which began November 9th, they finally got the Kaiser to abdicate, or they just announced it, and then the Kaiser left, and they announced the German Republic. And what happened was that the SPD broke with its radical wing, linked itself to some middle parties, the Catholic Center Party, and then the Liberal Party, the DDP, and they created a working coalition, held a new election in January. December was the crucial point. They held a new election in early January, and that was for a constituent assembly, that is, for an assembly that would make the Constitution. Since Berlin was still unstable, since there were still crowds in the streets, they looked for a place to meet, and they thought of the little city of Weimar, which also was at the heart of peaceful German culture and whatnot. And also it had a big city theater, a Stadttheater, that would seat over 500 delegates, which is typical for a German parliament to have that number. So they moved to Weimar just for the making of the Constitution. Not there was no sense of that being a capital. But they moved there to make the Constitution and created what we call the Weimar Constitution, and hence we call the whole thing the Weimar Republic, since the monarch was gone, it became a republic, and then they made the Constitution in Weimar. What they created was an extremely democratic welfare state, and I say democratic not in the kind of mainstream sense. I say it to all of you simpaticos, in the sense that it is democracy exactly as we know it. In other words, it's all about majoritarian rule, about manipulation by the elites, about voting other people's money into your own pocket, about all of that. And so everything that we conceive of as democracy in that sense was worked into that constitution. It was extremely responsive, extremely democratic. The politicians in Germany, socialists, liberals, all of them said, well, we have the most democratic country in the world. And I think they were right. I don't think there's anything incorrect about that. It was a true democracy. And very much on the way to being a total social welfare state. Well, anyway, the clashes continued. the government made a deal with the army that the army would not be completely gutted if the army would help restore order. The army agreed, and so there was fighting all over Germany in various cities. Remember, Germany was a federal state, and so in all the different capitals and all the different cities, there was fighting. And amazing and horrific things happened in many places. A Soviet regime took over in Munich, the capital of Bavaria, and ruled for several months, beginning a kind of the beginnings of the bloody purges and things. They only killed 500 or 600, but you know, nothing like Lenin's numbers in his first days. But at first they were kind of walking carefully, and then there was fighting. The governor raised troops to go back in and smash the Soviet, and before the end, the Soviets tortured and killed a bunch of hostages in a school in a very awful way, and then this led to reprisals by the conservatives against all communists. In fact, one thing that happens is that the brutalization of the war and the brutalization of the Bolshevik that came from the Bolshevik Revolution makes its way to the West, so that in beautiful middle class Munich, in beautiful royal Munich, then these awful things happen, and people take hostages from you know, just from the upper class or people they think are rich, take them into a school, and then hack off body parts and kill them. So it's a very ugly thing. Reds took over in Saxony as well for a while. They tried to take over elsewhere. Then the right, the counter-revolution started, and they too were brutalized by the war, and brutalized by the Russian, by hearing about the Russian Civil War, and brutalized by this whole atmosphere that we've been discussing with such intensity. And so they too gave no quarter. I mean, this man in the picture, it's a famous picture, a worker, a communist, no doubt, or somebody they thought was a communist. These Freikorps men, these volunteers have caught him, and they're going to shoot him. I mean, that's all there is to it. Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg were captured by army officers in Berlin, and the next thing you know, their bodies were found floating in the Landwehr Canal. When the officers were asked what happened, they said, "Oh, we shot them while they were trying to escape." I mean, Rosa Luxemburg was a 50-year-old woman. She wasn't in kind of dumpy. She wasn't running anywhere. She wasn't trying to escape. They just killed her. So this violence, this deterioration of civilization becomes very apparent in these coups, and the cop putsch, a coup from the right, and then Hitler's beer hall putsch in 1923, which is just another such attempt to take over from the right. In this case, an attempt to take over in Bavaria. And by the way, Ludendorff participated in that. Ludendorff was marching arm in arm with Hitler and his pals the day that they failed to take over the beer hall. The Munich government in the beer hall putsch. And then of course Hitler went into a genteel year prison, which enabled him to write Mein Kampf. And then the rest is history. So this post-war violence and Hitler's wartime rhetoric, all that leads directly to the rest, raises levels of anti-Semitism to unheard of, crude, horrific levels, raises levels of xenophobia to unheard of, crude levels in Germany. So this is all a terrible time in many more ways than one. Let's take a look at Austria. Almost nobody talks about the Austrian Revolution of 1918. And it didn't go as far. It didn't. There were not so many problems in Austria, and it's partly owing, just a bit of that's owing to Mises. Okay, I say that as a historian. It's not just because I'm writing fan fiction here or something. I am a fan, but it's not fiction. So in Austria, obviously the Habsburgs are in control until the end. But as with Germany, the generals have taken over to some extent. They've controlled the economy and so forth and so on. But the mass strikes that struck that really started rising in Germany in 1917, they really hit Austria hard from 1918 onward. There were strikes throughout the year. The Austrian war machine ground more and more slowly, and after the German Revolution started in Kiel at the end of October 1918, then there were mass demonstrations. That should be only one word. Demonstrations against the war and against the government, and eventually the armies surrendered on the battlefield, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire broke up. All right, that means that the component parts, Hungary, Austria, and then the Czech lands, just broke apart and made their own governments, most of them declaring republics along the way. The government, as in Germany, but a little bit earlier, actually, a few days, a week and a half earlier, was handed over to the Socialist Party with the same thought, that if the socialists can talk to the masses and kind of control the whirlwind a little bit. On November 12th, then, Austria is declared a republic, and that's the end for the Habsburgs. They started in the 13th century, moving to Vienna as their capital, and founding basically the Habsburg Empire at that point. And so from the 1300s to the 20th century, pretty good endings. In any case, I've thought of a course on the Habsburgs, too. That would be a fun, like, five-week Mises course just about the Habsburgs. Here we are in front of the Austrian Parliament. The crowds are out there. You see military hats there. You see middle-class hats. You see workers' hats. People thronging together to see what will happen, and that's all a crowd from November 12th, hearing that their monarchy no longer exists. Mises against the Socialist Revolution, 1919. A long time ago, 13th century is the 1200s. I just happened to look down and see the screen move. It is the 1200s. Since the 1200s, literally, to the 20th century. Hulsemann tells us this, and it summarizes well what's in Mises' notes and recollections and in Margit von Mises' My Life with Ludwig von Mises. But what happened was that Mises, who had come back from the front, been offered a role as professor in the University of Vienna, had also been working with the Chamber of Commerce, and so was deeply involved in the end of the wartime kind of planning and attempting to influence things. But when the government was formed, this socialist government, it turns out that the man who ended up in charge, a socialist, was Otto Bauer, who is now famous in socialist theory for being the first to advocate Euro-communism. I mean, he's a famous theorist. Well, they were classmates together at the University of Vienna, and Mises thought Bauer was quite a smart individual. And so when they formed the cabinet, actually Mises became a kind of adjunct to the cabinet. He was advising on economic matters to the Foreign Office, and of course that's everything in the wake of the war, what the Allies will do, whether they will demand reparations, how they will proceed. So they needed an economist, and there he was. But from this role, Mises worked to stop the complete transformation of the Austrian Republic as it was into a kind of Soviet Republic. And so that's what Mises did during this period. And I have the impression from his notes and recollections that he really looked on this period as a very important one in his life. And he speaks of it not just as saving, the free market, but to save civilization. Mises saw the middle class government, a kind of free, open government, even under the Habsburgs, even under monarchy. He saw this as civilization itself. And so this, I mean, from his later works, we know that he talked about civilization in this connection or that connection. But it's really interesting that he's talking about attempting to save civilization. There's more Bolsheviks around than you might think. Even in neighboring Bavaria, neighboring Hungary, we'll get to that in a minute, and so forth. So there's a lot going on besides just. Mises wrote in Notes and Recollections, Otto Bauer was too bright not to realize that I was right, but he never forgave me for having turned him into a Miron, which is a reference to French politics and meaning that he turned him from a revolutionary into a kind of cooperating socialist. The attacks of his fellow Bolshevists hit close to home, but he directed his animosity toward me instead of toward his opponents. A powerful loather, he opted for ignoble means to destroy me. So Mises sees himself as having dueled with Bauer through this period. And eventually, the Austrians did not adopt a Bolshevik regime. They too established a welfare regime, but it was divided up like the German system, partly between the Catholic Center Party, which advocated also a kind of welfare element, but in a slightly different way. So this combination helped kind of save Austria insofar as it was saved. Well, the losers. Let's just look at the losers. I mean, when we say that the empires were broken up at the end of the war, it's only the losing empires, right? Plus Russia, which lost by having its revolutions in 1917. In any case, Bulgaria, that's we can give Bulgaria a short shrift. Bulgaria was in numerous battles against the French and the Russians and the Turks and eventually lost. And they fell. The Allies gave a bunch of their land away, and they established a dictatorship. So enough into that. Let me just look into the Czechs for a moment. In Prague, well, the Czech lands, that is to say Bohemia and Moravia, were actually components of the losing side, right? So we're going to have treaties that punish Hungary and that punish Austria separately as countries. But, in fact, there was another component. There was another kingdom of the Austrian crown lands, and that was Bohemia. So how was it that Bohemia got to be well, not only a darling of the Allies, but also a kind of a big winner in all this? You might say, well, it's because the leaders of this new country, Thomas Masaryk and his friend Edward Beneš, that these guys were Democrats. Well, so were the Germans as of 1919. So and they were not given any credit for that. But what happened was that Masaryk had the amazing and important foresight that he should go to America and visit Wilson and use his influence and the influence of a lot of very well-to-do people who had taken up the kind of Slavic cause. And so he had access to Wilson and repeatedly told him how the Czechs were not anything like the Austrian Empire. They were nothing like the Central Powers. Remember, they'd been fighting as part of the Empire. They'd been administrators throughout the whole of the Habsburg Empire. But in any case, he was able to get the Czech case on the docket, so much so that eventually when the Allies set up the new state, they even took the Slovaks who spoke a similar language but really couldn't stand the Czechs. They even just chucked the Slovaks into the country and called it Czechoslovakia. So the Czechs could look forward under Masaryk to Allied support and being Entente members, although they were in no way on the Entente side during the war. So that's curious, with some adventures to follow. Hungary, another part of the loser alliance, as Austria-Hungary, as a half of the Habsburg Empire. There was a socialist revolution there on the heels of the war, and a socialist named Haile Karolyi took over again on October 31st. So it's all happening. Everything's happening at once. It's almost unbelievable how much happens in just these few days at the end of October, beginning of November 1918. King Charles IV accepts the Hungarian Democratic Republic on the 16th of November, but he eventually gets run off from the country, because in March, a Bolshevik, Béla Kun, you see him up at the top there speaking to a group of workers, he took power from the more moderate socialists, and he proclaimed the Hungarian Soviet Republic and ran it as such. He began shooting people. I said it about Munich, but he does this too. I mean, this is what communist regimes do. They have to shoot the old leaders and kill them off. But so all of the usual things, the collectives, the persecution of the nobles and the rich people, and the confiscation of property, all these things were in train. But by this time, the Allies were very upset with this, and Wilson in particular didn't like the communists. He didn't like Bolsheviks. He was very suspicious of them, as were the other Allied leaders. And so they sent emissaries down there. Smuts went to try to talk Béla Kun out of his communism, some other things were tried. But eventually, the Allies supported the Romanian army in an invasion. And there were some other elements to this inter-allied intervention. And Béla Kun was not killed. He just was run off. And then an independent kingdom of Hungary appeared. They put the king back on the throne and set him up. They needed somebody to sign the treaty, right? In other words, they were making peace at the same time, and so they needed somebody to sign the treaty. This Béla Kun is a wonderful creature of World War I. I mean, if Ludendorff is a creature, Lloyd George is a creature, and Lenin is a creature, well, so is Béla Kun. He changed his name from Kohn early in life and called himself a more Hungarian type of name, Béla Kun, instead of his Jewish family name. During the war, he had fought in the Austro-Hungarian army, captured in 1916. You can see it there on this line. In a Russian POW camp, he became a communist and participated in the Bolshevik Revolution. Then, after fighting with the Bolsheviks in the Civil War, he returned to Hungary in November 1918, started fomenting a revolution, became head of the government, and then was ousted in August 1919. So he had successfully, or partly successfully, established a Soviet regime that just didn't take. So he fled to Moscow and was involved in the Comintern, was a special agent to go to different places to foment revolution, Germany in particular, then ended up back in Russia after these adventurous times, and was eventually purged by Stalin in 1937 and shot in 1938. So much for him, but a real World War I life, a real creature of the war. Well, let me talk about the peace conference for a moment. And as I say, this merits a completely, well, an additional course. Let me just make some points about it, because we've got a lot more to do tonight than just talk about this. But it was a dictated peace. The Germans, for example, during the peace talks, were not even permitted to be in France. France did not issue any visas for Germans during the whole period of time. No German was permitted to be on French soil, except for the two occasions on which the German delegation was invited by name. Each of the people in the delegation were given visas, and those people were allowed to come and stay in a guarded hotel in Paris and attend the conference, but just for a few days, long enough to, in the first place, to receive the terms, and then in the second place to sign the treaty in June 1919. So there can be no argument that it was a dictated peace because there was no negotiation whatsoever. By the way, we call it, just by way of terminology, it's the Paris Peace. That's the overall peace. And then there were five treaties, one with each of the losing powers. So there was the Versailles Treaty, that was the German treaty. There was the Treaty of Saint-Germain. These were all signed in the palaces around the Paris. They used to call them the treaties of this Paris suburbs. So Versailles, Saint-Germain, which was with Austria, then the Treaty of Trianon with Hungary, and then the Treaty of Neuilly in with Bulgaria, and finally the treaty of Sèvres, like the China, with the Ottomans, and that one would become rewritten a little bit later on, but Sèvres is the original treaty. So those five treaties make up the Paris Peace. So if we talk about the Versailles Peace, it's technically incorrect, but I mean, everybody knows what you mean, but you can take this piece of knowledge if you didn't have it and maybe use it at cocktail parties to amaze your interlocutors at those parties. Okay, well, another thing that the conference that we need to think of at the conference that is that this was a war which had turned on financial manipulation, as we've seen from the very beginning. And then the trajectory of the war, it required huge kinds of financial solutions and all these new total war solutions and the manipulation of currency to debts nobody had ever known before. And so those financial considerations become the heart and soul, in some ways, of the treaties, especially the Versailles Treaty with the Germans. That has to do with, of course, reparations, and then how the Germans will pay that, and then eventually the Americans step in and say, well, we'll loan the Germans the money to pay the reparations, and the reparations money will be used to pay the Americans the war loans, and the money just circulates around. Each time it passes through New York, the cash registers ring, and they make their money on those fees, etc. So that's an important part of the treaty, the financial part. And a large number of folks in the American delegation were, in fact, just basically Morgan partners or bankers who worked with the Morgans all the time. We could say that the treaties also partook of the new brutality, the new callousness about human life, about family life, about severing connections in countries, about drawing boundaries, sometimes went through towns, and about ratcheting people apart in all kinds of, wrenching people apart in all kinds of ways. So then what I would call a kind of new sense of brutality, kind of confirmed, almost legal brutality, emerges with this conference. A lot of talk about self-determination. But when you get right down to it, and we can talk about this in the question and answer if you like, but when you get right down to it, Woodrow Wilson at the conference, when he's talking about national self-determination, he's really talking about nationalism. In other words, it's not that he sees some new way of helping people determine their what will happen in their own lives. He's really very, very interested in groups of Europeans adhering to each other on an ethnic basis. And he argues that more than once in the considerations of the Council Forum. Finally, there's this American problem, and it's a huge problem. I think Lloyd George tells us something about this when he said this, asked how he does peace conference. He said, "Well, not badly, considering I was seated between Jesus Christ and Napoleon." I mean, it's a conference of these big personalities. Orlando, the Italian, is not as important a personality. In fact, he leaves the conference at one point, and is clearly a lesser ally. The Big Four is really just the Big Three in many, many ways. So it's these three personalities, Lloyd George, and then, as he's saying, a person who has a messiah complex, which some, you know, some psychobiographical writers have said that more than once. And then Napoleon, who also had a kind of messiah complex. So Clemenceau and Wilson were these personalities. But I've got to say this, Lloyd George was some kind of personality himself. And I don't know if he's calling Wilson a Jesus Christ, or a would-be Jesus Christ, and Clemenceau a would-be Napoleon. I'm not sure who Lloyd George would be. Maybe a would-be Machiavelli. I don't know. But he's a, you know, that statement is funny, but we might say he's a heck of a one to talk. The American problem, the peacemaker as he really is. These are words by William Orpin, who was an official British painter of the war, and the official portrait painter one of two official painters at the peace conference. A wonderful, wonderful artist, and we have seen some of his pieces already, and we'll see a couple more in a moment. But these are informal sketches and drawings that he made just for his own amusement. He wrote to his friend afterwards, well, here's the peacemaker as he really is. His spelling and construction there. There's more on this at this link at the LSU library. These are wonderful little sketches. Orpin sat with Wilson a long time and has some interesting comments. He wrote a memoir of the peace conference, and that's it's well worth reading. But Wilson comes to the conference to save the world. What did Wilson want in his mind? I don't know. These psychologists who say that he had a messiah complex, I think, I'm no psychologist. I don't know if that's true or not. But certainly he seems to have been swayed by the fact that the United States comes unscathed into a war where everybody is blasted, everybody's exhausted, where attrition has just about hollowed out 200 years of industrial revolution and the rise of standard of living. And he comes into this, and so they act like he's the arbiter of everything. He gets on the ship, the USS Washington, and brings with him his inquiry, his scholars, and he tells them on the ship, tell me what is right, and I will fight for it in his unctuous way. And then he gets to Europe, and he makes a tour of Italy, and he goes to Paris. He goes to all the big European cities that were part of the Entente, and he gets ticker tape parades everywhere. They treat him like he's undergoing an apotheosis. And so, yes, messiah complex. He's certainly acting like it. And then he gets to Paris, down to brass tacks in mid-January, and Clemenceau is the president. Wilson has been out of shape because Clemenceau has made all these deals along the way, and he's been out of shape because Lloyd George won't agree with him on all kinds of issues, and they're both just after what their country's after, but he's this high-minded person who wants to recreate Europe and create open covenants, openly arrived at, et cetera, et cetera. So, this is a huge, huge problem. Because he's spouting all of these platitudes, while behind him all the bankers, all the Morgan, and now in league with the even Rockefeller minions are making hay while the sun shines. I mean, it's a very disgusting spectacle in many ways. The peacemaker as is. Well, I just want to point out that the big four, all of them were serial reformers, serial statists, and serial killers. I started to add up how many each of these killed on the average per month or got killed while they were in office, but it was too depressing, so I stopped. But you can do the math. I mean, it's easily found out. Just figure out how long they were in office and how many of their own folks they got killed. I guess, as I say, Orlando, and you see him in the picture, the third from the right, he's the least of these guys in terms of the destruction he did to the modern world. He was just a mafioso. I mean, I think he really was literally quite a quite a prominent man of honor, as they call him in Sicily, and this has come out in several studies. So I think he at least was an honest criminal, you know, and didn't make any bones about that. So why is this piece a kind of design for a violent century? I mean, was this piece set up to bring further destruction down the way? I really wrestled with this question, and some of you may have read parts of pieces of my blog on the Paris Peace Conference. About 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I decided to kind of work through a year, the anniversary, you know, the decade, the whatever it was, the, let's see, 1919, it was 2009, the 90th year of the anniversary of the Paris Peace. And so I wrote a blog, and it's still up, and you can read all that. I just wrote little essays about each aspect as it came to me, and my idea is that that there was a design, that in a way that these peacemakers got there, and everybody wants to design the future, but what they designed in that process was a century that's going to be extremely, extremely violent, the most violent in human history, in recorded history anyway, and it's hard to imagine just in terms of the sheer number of murders by government, death by government, as Rummel says. It's hard to imagine a more violent century. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to be able to do all that killing that was produced by these decisions made by these guys at the peace conference, and their backers, and the scholars, and the professors from Princeton and Harvard and Yale, and the newspaper men, and the London bankers, and the New York bankers, and the French elites. I mean, so you're going to be hard pressed to find decisions that look more like they were designed. I mean, surely, as the war ended, it was in the mind of elites that what they needed to do was to reshape the world so they could get more profit out of it. Many of them, I think, well intentioned in this. They didn't think, I think that many of these people didn't think about themselves as being evil. They thought about themselves as being smarter than everybody else. They thought of themselves in a positivist way, that is to say, that they were far-seeing wise men and therefore could kind of create a world that was better. I mean, there's Wilson right there, but I think the others just as well. Even these leaders, even as superficial as the leaders were, as sort of front men to the designers of the next century, I think they all had ideas about reforming the world. You know, Lloyd George was a huge campaigner against alcohol. He said at one point during the war, "We have two enemies in this war. One of them is the Germans, and the other is drink." Imagine saying that in the UK. Imagine what response you get to that idea of the enemy. And so, all my UK friends out there, I recognize your prowess. That's all I'm doing with that statement. I'm recognizing your prowess. But in any case, if you want to read more on this issue with some detailed kinds of things and other sorts of stuff about the peace conference, you're welcome to peruse that blog. So here's another Orpin painting, William Orpin, and this is the signing of the treaty. The person signing is Johannes Bell in the seat at the front. And you see the superior looks that Orpin puts into this painting. And you see also, I think, something very interesting, that all these guys, let's see, where can I put this? Here we go. All these guys here, just look at that line of folks going all up and down. They're all on one side of the table, and there is Johannes Bell, one of the peace delegates. All the delegates have to sign it, and he's a government official. And so it's him on one side and all these characters on the other. These are the winners. he's the loser. You get that picture, don't you? Yeah, it's a kind of a Last Supper picture. It really is. A Last Supper with a loser on the other side of the table. So, yeah, that's a good point. You know, I hadn't thought of that. It is a last. I'm sure Orpen meant that too. So, yeah, very interesting. So, in fact, Orpen was a fairly, for being an official portrait painter, he's a pretty irreverent guy. He was an Irishman. He had been hired by the government to go paint the war. And they didn't like a lot of his paintings. In fact, many of them had to be redone and repainted and have pieces painted out because his bosses didn't like what he painted. So he's a very interesting character to follow through the conference. But anyway, the signing of the German treaty, the Versailles Treaty, was in the Hall of Mirrors on the 28th of June. You get the significance of the 28th of June. That's the day that the Archduke was assassinated in 1914. And then the other treaties were signed throughout 1919 and up, 1919. I want to point out that there's still a war going on in essence after the war ended. It's the Russian Civil War, and that all of the Allied countries, plus others that they brought into it, intervened against the Soviets in that war to help the whites, and the Soviets won anyway. Here are Americans. I mean, just in case you've missed it, this covers many of the countries that all of us are in right now and or from, and so we've got a bunch of people who intervened in a bunch of different ways. But the revolutionaries still were able to maintain their hold on thing. But I mentioned that kind of in passing. And this must be a blank slide. But I want to end up just by talking a little bit more about destruction. There's Malcolm has talked about in the forum in recent times about the destruction of the land. And there is good information on that French Wikipedia page. Yeah, a lot more than on the English one. Very good work and well worth reading, because the destruction of the zone of the Western Front was so in many ways so complete. And as we've talked about and discussed previously, this destruction kind of forms a kind of framework for the future. The destruction of the land allowed that land to be reconstructed, and therefore much of the reparation money was funneled through companies that were reconstructing the land, reconstructing the villages, reconstructing the roads and the sawmills and the brick plants and all that, so that we do have an analog for the modern next is that I think we all see now. We get somebody who runs a war, and he's associated with a company who builds things in the wake of wars, and then when the war's over, his company jumps in and gets the contracts to build these things, and they make zillions of dollars, so that it's a transfer of money from taxpayers to these companies. And so I think this was in the process of becoming at this point. And that this was being calculated and figured out. And so a lot of this destruction is in that way. Here's one of the zones that was just good for nothing. The Haute Chevauche. It's in the edge of Lorraine in the Meuse-Argonne sector of the war, where the French held the lines against the Germans, or faced the Germans for most of the war, and then the Americans came in afterward. And it's land that is today just no good except for trees. I mean, they grow some lumber on it. But it's every square inch is undermined and has some big trenches still left and unexploded shells and all the kinds of leakage of those that you could imagine, and bunkers and all of it. And so much of that Western Front, you know, again, it becomes a kind of battlefront, home front thing. Even after the war is over, it keeps killing. And indeed, the shells keep killing up to today, up to, you know, just 2 years ago. There was a big crisis when one of the shell dumps in Belgium was found to have leaking shells in it. But farmers find shells all the time, and people get blown up by shells occasionally still, especially in trying to remove them, as somebody did at Vimy Ridge. A Canadian bomb expert was killed at Vimy Ridge just a couple of years ago attempting to remove a shell that had been found to be very close to where, you know, visitors come to the Vimy Ridge Battlefield Park. So there's all that kind of destruction. Let me say a few words about war cemeteries, a very real kind of which represent a very real kind of destruction. If you visit the Western Front, and I do absolutely recommend this, many of you probably have done it. If you live in America, it's a little bit of a proposition to get there. But if you get a chance to make your way down part or even all of the Western Front from the sea, the Belgian seacoast, all the way to Switzerland, what you find is that the war is really defined today by the graves of the people who are in it. And it's a bit of a shock because you say, okay, well, the war happened and people are taking, you know, there's no, well, this is a long time afterwards, right? But there's cemetery after cemetery after cemetery, and they're German and French and Belgian and mixed, and then more German and then Portuguese and then Indian, and then they just go on and on and on. And so as you go through that zone of the Western Front and just drive the little country roads along it, you are in the company of all these cemeteries and thousands upon thousands of graves. This war was above all destructive of human life and of human future life, but human present life as well. So I'm going to give you a few examples of these. There are hundreds and hundreds of cemeteries. I'm just talking about a couple of them here. At Verdun, right around the back lot of where the fortress of Douaumont was held by the French and attacked by the Germans in the Battle of Verdun, there are 16,142 French war graves there. You see them in front. And then in the back is the ossuary. That's a place where they, for those of you who don't know, where they display bones of departed persons. And in the ossuary, there are 130,000 individuals' remains in the form of bones. And they are visible in that monument. In this area here, if you look, if you walk along, you just walk along the outside of the monument, and you can, those bones are visible. And they're mixed. So Germans and French all mixed together. Here, it's the reality of war, and you get a sense of the numbers too. This is a similar kind of a place. This is Kynecott Cemetery. It's a British cemetery and New Zealand cemetery with a special New Zealand part to it. It's also a memorial to the missing. It's on the ridge of Passchendaele, so it's what the Allies were attacking toward when they had his soldiers carry out this mud battle up this horrific long ridge. And this is right at the top. They nearly made it to the ridge, but it's as far as they made it to this little town. And Kynecott is just simply a reference to some local landmarks, a couple of German strong points that actually are here in front and then over here, if you can see that mark. So those are actually German kind of like pillboxes, but strong points on the German line. And then there's another one there that's covered over with a monument that has a cross on top. So there are not as many people represented here as in Verdun, but there are nearly 12,000 graves, and over 8,000 are unnamed graves. In other words, in this kind of battle, as in Verdun, there are just an awful lot of people whose remains are never identified. Then this whole affair up here, the semicircular affair that you can see there. That is one of the two memorials to the missing for the battles of Ypres. The other we saw in a previous slide a few weeks ago, the Menin Gate, and this is the second one. Visits to these cemeteries are, I think, quite important. I recommend that if you get to do that, that you do that. And I don't know why that slide disappeared. Here's the German military cemetery at Fladslo. It's in Belgium. It's close to the city of Dixmude, and 26,000 soldiers are buried here in mass graves. These graves that you see in the picture here, they do have crosses up. You can see these lugubrious black basalt crosses, but the graves are graves of 20 per grave. And who knows if they're actually buried in one mass grave and they just made the markers later, because all these cemeteries were restructured after the war. Started out as burial places on the battlefield or in the rear of the battlefield, and then became permanent after the war. But Fladslo has a very special spirit to it. It has a kind of German funeral aspect to it, and the customs of Germans and use of certain trees in their cemeteries and so forth. And it also has a famous sculpture at it by a famous sculptress named Käthe Kollwitz, the German one of the most famous German sculptors of the 20th century. Here she made a double portrait, a portrait basically of herself and her husband, called Mourning Parents, because her son was killed in 1914 and is buried at Fladslo Cemetery, just in front of the father. And this is about as moving a thing as you can see. The grief expressed here in the Fladslo Cemetery, and the pain and numbness on the face of these parents. There's another type of cemetery. Or we could go to Gallipoli and go to the Turkish 57th Division Cemetery Memorial, and you can see the size of it. It's more human in size, I think. You can see the people up there walking around in this memorial. I mean, these walls are not especially high, and this little tower is not anything like the big massive structures at other places. So the graves are out here. In a way, this is more of a symbolic cemetery. A more normal cemetery is this mass grave at Alçatepe, which is also in the battlefield of Gallipoli. There are hundreds of cemeteries on the battlefield. This mass grave, as you see, was to take care of the mass bodies that were killed as the Turks defended against the Allies at Gallipoli. Again, in Turkey, as elsewhere, they often incorporated these kinds of battlefield things into the cemetery itself. Same way at Montfaucon, at the American Military Cemetery, which is the largest military cemetery in Europe, in the Meuse-Argonne sector, and it's a haunting place. You see the cemetery in the old picture. Just after the war, the battlefield marks have been cleaned off a little bit, but you can see all over here these marks of shell holes and shelling and all that. And then the town of Montfaucon, or the village of Montfaucon, was here. And on this hill where the village was, the Americans set up a column. And there's actually a little arrow drawn on this black and white picture column is, and you can see that right there. But in any case, I just made a yellow line where this column is. I mean, if you put that column on the battlefield, on the cemetery, and so there's a big memorial up here, and then in this area out here, there are these graves in a quite astounding picture that could sort of stand for war in the 20th century in many ways, this aerial photograph of hundreds and hundreds of dead Americans fighting in Europe well-reasoned that we have been through already. And then there are places that are much smaller and much less imposing in many ways. Here's the Devonshire Cemetery, opposite Mammoth's Woods, 153 graves only. Many of these were graves where the Devonshires were killed by shelling, by machine guns when they attacked on in their part of the Somme battle, and were buried by their comrades in these very trenches that they had occupied. And so the memorial stone at the gate says, as you can probably read on this slide, the Devonshires held this trench, the Devonshires hold it still. So you have an enormous range of emotions, I think human emotions that come through these vast engines of the state. Here's Dartmoor British Cemetery in the Somme sector, and there are 763 graves here, but they include the graves of the father and son. Sergeant George Lee and his son Robert Lee were killed. they served in the same artillery battalion and were killed in the same battery and were killed in action the same day, September 5th, 1916. So it was a world at war. I hope we've iterated and reiterated that fact enough. You see people from all over. You see Chinese labor. One on the Western Front, we see Portuguese troops. Nurses from the Midlands in England would travel all across the world. Or young women from Philadelphia went to Russia as aid workers during the war to alleviate hunger in Poland during the war. The Choctaws, who are our nearest neighbors here in North Texas, just across the river in Oklahoma, the Choctaw Reservation. We know them well, and here are Choctaws in off fighting in France, and Indian troops, and Scots wearing their kilts in the trenches, and you just get the picture of this whole world upheaval, and interacting in ways that were all about destruction rather than about human interaction and honest exchanges and mutually beneficial exchanges. What these people were forced to exchange was anything but beneficial. Here, I think, is maybe the oddest kind of a thing. It's Maori tribesmen from New Zealand in the Anzacs doing their haka, that great ceremony that's so prominent in black. What is the team? The Blacks. I forget the where they. It's their New Zealand rugby team, and they do that haka before every game. You've probably seen this, but it's a kind of ritual of before battle. The All Blacks. That's right. The All Blacks. And here they are doing a haka on the sands of Egypt. Okay. Just amazing. Here are Lancashire Fusiliers on their way to Gallipoli in Turkey, partway across the globe. So you get the picture here. 10 million soldiers died, 7 million civilians died, and that doesn't count the Spanish flu, which was without a doubt generated because of the way that the war was fought, the way that soldiers were trained. It doesn't count the blockade deaths of German civilians. It doesn't count the communist slaughters in the Civil War or the white terror of retaliation in the war. It doesn't count famine and disease in all the countries. 400,000 dead in Serbia and Croatia and Slovenia alone. This war is indeed a calamity. And again, one more emphasis on the fact that this total war state created not just the totalitarians, Lenin and Hitler and Mussolini, but also the total interventionist state, the total technocratic leadership state. It created this, it really created the modern world and all of its destructiveness. So with that, I will say that we have done our job, and we have finished before Christmas, but we have questions and answers to come. And so we were running a little late tonight. We started about 15 minutes late, and I'm happy to go as long as you would like to go with questions. So let me just take a quick break and read the chat to see if there are questions already on the board that we could answer, and you can be thinking of others. Okay. Okay, Louis asks the first question that I see. If there are others that I missed before that, let me know. Who appointed Prince Max if he did not want to be, if he did not want to go anymore in September? How do you get a military dictatorship out of the top? Well, Louis, good question. This is what you see, don't you see? This is what Ludendorff did. He ran Germany into the ground. He introduced the total war state, but then he realized that he was going to lose. He didn't want anything to do with losing, so he pushed it off on the civilians. And then right after the war, he said, well, I didn't really lose the war. I was stabbed in the back by those awful civilians back in Berlin, and Jews and socialists and liberals. I was winning, and I looked around, and we were all stabbed in the back by the workers who were striking and all these things. So he didn't want anything to do with it. He wanted to get, the war became for him a hot potato, and he wanted to put it in the hands of somebody else. Prince Max understood, I mean, he was a capable and interesting person, and he understood the perils of taking over when something is at its low point like that, but I think he thought it was his duty, and so he took over and the negotiations happened between leading personalities. There was a prime minister, there was a chancellor of Germany, a prime minister, who, and a cabinet who, you know, had been going through the motions, and now suddenly they had real decisions to make. And they decided basically to quit and get Prince Max to form a government. So that's the answer to that one. Let's see. Did Bauer have any influence on Mies' employment? You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't remember that. I bet that Hulsmann tells us that in the biography, because Mises was certainly kept out of the ranks of the professoriate. When he came back from the war, he served not as an ordinarius, that's a full professor in the German and Central European system. He served as an extraordinarius, and so he was serving as kind of adjunct professor anyway, and thereafter he was certainly kept at arm's length for the whole time. So yeah, I have no doubt that that's related, but I don't know that for sure. I mean, I just can't quote it, but I bet that Hulsmann tells us. The Last Supper of Europe, I like it. Who is looking over the shoulder to make sure he signs it correctly or gives up the good? That's a good one. I like that. Yeah, it's a functionary. I mean, I'm sure we could find his name. Orban probably has all his labels somewhere, but I don't know. Free Halliburtons, yeah, all blacks. Okay, so we get down to Malcolm's question here. To what extent did the philosophy of positivism play in instigating World War I and the following wars? Is there an article that you can recommend that covers this topic in depth? Well, somebody will think of something. Cam will think of something while I'm answering this, I bet. I can't think of a particular article, although Rothbard discusses this in a number of different places. And Mises discusses it in the Omnipotent Government for sure, and probably Nation, State, and Economy, if I'm not getting that wrong. I could have that wrong, so somebody will correct me on those. But But in terms of the role of positivism, yes, it did play, I think, a very important role. We talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the course. Certainly, the positivists, the Comteans, were direct ancestors. They're direct ancestors to the American progressives. Clemenceau was as a French radical, capital R, and participant in the French system, was very much a Comtean. The French were even more Sansimonian in many ways than they were Comtean. So they all went back to the teacher of Comte, Saint-Simon. And I think again that this leads into the whole idea that there is a kind of wise class of people in France, probably more on the basis of merit than wealth and birth, but those contribute. But in all these countries, I believe these classes of folks who thought themselves to be the planners of the future, like Colonel House, whom we talked about. You remember. He was the alter ego to Wilson. He just wanted to plan. He was so wise. He didn't need to be in politics. He just needed to be the kind of person behind the throne who charted the course of humanity. You know, he wrote this awful novel called Philip Drew Administrator, kind of a novel with somebody just like himself as a hero who gets to make up the laws for people and administer everybody. It's total Comtean philosophy. So yeah, there's an awful lot of this involved in the war. And then war then as fulfillment is perfect for these people because it fulfills so many aspects. Kathy asks, is there any evidence, truth to the idea that the anarchist who killed the Archduke was funded by the British and or French? Kathy, I don't know of any direct evidence of that at all. I've heard some suggestions about who was backing Princip, and I know that some people argue that it was not really the Serbians and the Serbian secret police who did it, or that the Serbian secret police were acting at the behest of some other power. This one I just don't know about, and I haven't, every suggestion of it that I've tried to run down showed no hard evidence whatsoever, so I do not know about that. It's one of these things. It sounds like it could have happened, but I haven't seen any evidence at all. No indications in my mind at all. But if you run across one, please let me know. I mean, I'd like to know more. Okay, let's see. From Malcolm. Since writing your paper some caused the Great War, what other ways have you learned that the privacy of the individual is lost? Currently, we live in a society where the personal lives of everyone is not only fair game, but where society feels they have the right to know about the personal lives of their neighbors. It's almost as if it is a duty to know. This is just a short step from the socialist collective reporting of oppressive regimes. Do you have examples of government promoting this view in World War I? How did the Sedition Act affect loss of personal privacy? Well, the Sedition Act, just like DORA and just like the German dictatorship and all these regimes, encourage people to snitch on their neighbors, encourage people to pry. It's a very good point you make, Malcolm, that it's not only that the government destroys our own privacy in these ways, but we also become agents in informing. Of course, all the totalitarian regimes, and remember, they were all First World War based. They all have little, heroes who informed on their parents, or young pioneer heroes, or young communist heroes who informed on their, denounced their parents and got them sent to the camps. They're all held up to be heroes, and so those people who inform on their neighbors, I think that's a really good point. Maybe I should put that into a second article and call it Some More Costs of the Great War, or Son of Some Costs of the Great War. But anyway, I think there's just a zillion. I mean, I think I see all this as a Higgsian crisis that bumped us into a new world. And everything's receded a little bit from it. I mean, the world that existed thereafter, it took the Depression and the war and the Cold War and these generations to make this the kind of, you know, people are always saying, well, why don't the mainstream media, you know, why do these educators all say this? Why is everybody connected to this sort of, you know, mainstream, liberal, whatever you call it, line? And, well, it's because, you know, it's like the ring. It wants to go back to his master, right? I mean, the ring wants to be found. And it's this thing that's been promoted. It's been promoted through education. It's been promoted through the education of journalists, the education of teachers, and those teachers have taught others, and those journalists have persuaded others, and those government officials have persuaded others, so that now it becomes a kind of party line, and we get the responses to everything that happens in the news is this response, and finally then we get these horrific events of the 2000s where people say, oh, keep me safe at any cost, I don't mind, here, take my little girl and take her away for an hour and do with her what you will, as long as we're safe, I'm fine. So I think you're on the right track there, Malcolm. I mean, I agree with you completely about that. Leslie says, in Hayek's Counter-Revolution of Science, does he deal with consequences of French positivism for the 20th century history? Let's see, did somebody else answer that? Yeah, I don't, it sounds right, but it's been a while, so it sounds right. My memory's not what it once was, Leslie. Even what it once was yesterday, but so it's worse today. Let's see. Malcolm Arnold says, in some costs of the Great War, you say, outlawing both public and private foreign language schools, have you learned of any other education that was outlawed? How was religion promoted? What was taught in the Americanization classes you mentioned? Oh, well, I'll start from the end. The Americanization classes were all about being a patriot, and those were about denouncing spies, for sure. I mean, there's some of your denouncing, if you want, as if we needed more of it. But they were about, it was like civics. When I was in high school, they had a course called civics, and it was about teaching how to say the Pledge of Allegiance and what it really meant, and how to adhere to your country, and how to have one nation, and all that stuff. And it was kind of like that. And it was also saying, you know, we don't adhere to the old kings because kings are bad, and we don't adhere to these bad old ways of the old world. Part of the Americanization, of course, was homogenization to make sure that all the immigrants' children didn't remain un-American in the way that they were. So that was what was in those. Now, I don't think religion was promoted. I think a civic religion was promoted, but I don't think religion was promoted. I think religions got hit by this just as everybody else did. And so we get, after the war, we get churches who adopt a kind of mishmash kind of socialism to go along with, to mix in with whatever their doctrine happened to be. And so I don't think religion was promoted, but maybe polluted a little bit in many sectors by this war. Well, people quit teaching German, and they quit teaching the languages of the enemy, and they quit teaching German history as being anything worthy or good. A lot of politically incorrect subjects. I mean, we have politically incorrect subjects today, but it's just our current wave of them. There have always been these incorrect subjects ever since the state took over education. It just depends on what the time is and all that. But a lot of subjects did certainly get outlawed. Leslie Webb says, I think the Russian ambassador to Serbia knew in advance about the plot. And I read that too. I couldn't, I couldn't follow it out to the proof, but maybe there is a footnote there that I didn't see. Let's see, Kathy. Yeah, I mean, if somebody, Leslie, if you can figure out where you read that, that would be very useful to know. I apologize if I fell asleep at some point, but I don't recall you talking much about poison gas. Well, we talked about it just a little about the creation of it and Fritz Haber. If I didn't fall asleep, I mean, maybe I just dreamt it. But it marks the war, and as an especially horrible thing. You know, there's a little discussion. Is it Malcolm who asked about the, or somebody else? No, it was Erica. I can't remember. Somebody asked about this on the forum, and I gave some references to this the other day. The thing about poison gas was that the minute it appeared on the battlefield, the other side and the soldiers themselves started doing something about it. And the methods of delivering it were improved throughout the whole war, but by the same token, the soldiers got more canny at knowing that one gas would float. They would know how to tell the differences in the gases, that some gases would float in the hollows and some would blow in the wind, and some you had to protect your skin and some you had to protect your lungs and so forth. So in the end, there were not as many casualties by a long shot from poison gas as there were from artillery, which, you know, an artillery shell falls on you. There's no, whether you can say, oh, yes, that's a German 88 millimeter thing, boom, and you're dead. I mean, there's just no, it doesn't matter. Whereas with poison gas, there is sometime to react, and soldiers reacted accordingly. Now, my friend Gordon Corrigan, who wrote a couple of good books about World War One, or fun books about World War One. I don't agree with him on everything, but Gordon one time said to me, in fact, he said in front of a group of students I was taking on a tour of the Western Front of World War One. He said, well, they all talk about this poison gas, but that's ridiculous. And poison gas hardly killed anybody in World War One. And I said, well, Gordon, let me ask you this. My grandfather's brother, who was gassed in France and died 10 years after the war because his lungs were destroyed, I think his folks would disagree with you. What do you say to that? And so there's a tendency to debunk this a little bit, but it was certainly, it gave the war a definite kind of horror. You know, Haber's wife, Fritz Haber, was the man who masterminded the delivery system for the first gas shells at St. Julian's on the Ypres battlefield in April 1915. And Haber's a Nobel Prize winner. He's the guy who discovered how to fix nitrogen. He's a really important scientist in the 20th century. And he was a German Jew who was a patriot and wanted to help his country, and he invented this poison gas. His wife later committed suicide, and there's been some speculation, we don't know for sure, that she just couldn't live with the fact that he had invented poison gas. But it was an especially horrible aspect of the war, but one that was, again, controllable. It was, you know, if you'd asked the soldiers which they feared the most, it would have been artillery, hands down. I hope that that helped you. We've talked, I think, a little bit about it, but on the other hand, I may have forgotten to talk about it. So I'm glad you asked the question that I did. Let's see. Check this. Oh, Cam has a good. Thank you, Cam. He has a something on positivism. Let's see. Leslie Webb says she thinks it's Columbia University's Western Civilization Great Books course. Okay. Excellent. Malcolm Arnold says, yeah, how is religion or thinking thereof changed? Well, I think that would, that is a huge topic. Well, everything was changed by this war. Not everything. So many things. If you know the work of a great libertarian scholar, historian David Beito, V-E-I-T-O, a fantastic historian at the University of Alabama, he wrote a brilliant book about fraternal associations and medical care before World War One, so that nearly everybody in the pre-World War One period had some kind of medical coverage / insurance / burial policy because they got in fraternal organizations, they were cooperative organizations, and the products were offered at cheap, depending on, I mean, you could order more a fancier burial plot, but in fact, you could order what you afforded, and people of very modest means could afford a policy that would make sure they were buried, that would make sure they had some basic medical care, there were doctors basically on the network. Now, they were not necessarily brain surgeons at Columbia University, but still in all, people had various kinds of medical practitioners who would look after them, midwives and homeopathic doctors and people who could treat some diseases and give people some help. But after the war, what happened was that increasingly these licensing agencies excluded all the types of medicine that were not being taught at the medical schools. And the AMA became a very powerful lobbying association in the United States, and these fraternal associations were pretty much run out of business. And what that did was to make it's very much like when Henry VIII wiped out all the monasteries in England and confiscated their wealth. That took away a kind of private safety net for society, and so did this process after World War One. So read David Beito's book on this, super book and super stuff, and it shows you another type of these changes that occurred as a result of the war, in the wake of the war, and partly as a result. Okay, discussion of bibliography, excellent. I'm down to Erica's question. Why was there such a disregard for human life in this era? Where did it come from? Oh, man, that's a big question. That is a huge question, Erica. I don't think I can even begin to answer that, but I've tried to answer this for myself, and I'm working gradually on a project that's about that. I think the brutality and the disregard for human life is I think it comes with all these things that we've been talking about. I think that that nationalism, as it was influenced by a special kind of social Darwinism, was responsible. I think Mises states this clearly too, certainly in Omnipotent Government, he discusses it that way. I think that positivism, which was also interrelated, in other words, a lot of the positivist thought meshed very well with social Darwinist thought. And so there's that aspect too. The imperialism, which again is interconnected with these other areas and sets up a whole ideology of being superior and making decisions for our little brown brothers, as Taft called Filipinos. So there's all of this that goes into it, so that, and then the cruelties and the brutalities that were thought to be necessary to discipline these childlike foreigners in the Philippines or in Africa or wherever. So I think all of these things come into it. The whole imperial connection is very closely associated. But one thing is, once the state forces people into a situation where they are, and face it, this goes for any war. This goes for soldiers who are there today who are on the battlefront, face to walk through situations which are just simply impossible. And when governments force people to do this, it forces them to be brutal. And remember, we talked about how the state worked against the quiet sectors and the truces on the Western Front, how the state added weapons that had nothing to do with military prowess and the accomplishment of strategy, but yet were about the brutalization of people and the aggression and the killing. So I think all of those go together. So that after the war, you know, we get to the renegotiation of the Ottoman Treaty, the Treaty of Sèvres, which was the fifth of our five Paris peace treaties. And once Ataturk or Mustafa Kemal was able to kind of save the country and fought a war of invasion on all fronts and set up a new Turkey, he got the Allies to renegotiate that. And in the Treaty of Lausanne, all the powers agreed that because there were a lot of Greeks in Turkey and a lot of Turks in Greece, that there would be an exchange of populations, that it would just be, you know, we just swap these for these. Never mind that the families of each had lived in these places for 1,000 years, and never mind that all their property was there and all the lives that their families had built over generations, they'd just be swapped. Never mind the brutality of that. And in fact, this kind of mutual bilateral ethnic cleansing took place with great brutality. But the Allies just said, well, as long as it doesn't take place with huge brutality, it's just a little brutality. In other words, it's government sanctioned, it's internationally sanctioned brutality and disregard for the individual and human life, and that comes out of the war too. That is really the way that works. Okay, let's see. Big question though. I was co-editor of a volume. I organized a conference about ethnic cleansing in modern Europe, and there's some explanation in there. I think that book is online. If you want the link, send to me, and I will tell you. But somebody put it online in chapters, and that's great. I'm glad they did that. It makes it a little bit available. But if you read that book, and let's see, that's it. My ethnic cleansing book came out 2003, and I just wanted to show you this. It's fat, and we didn't even begin to cover all the cases of ethnic cleansing in just in Europe. This, not to mention Africa or Asia or any place else. These are all different cases in this, whatever it is. It's a lot of book. It's nearly 800 pages of book, and that makes for a depressing a few nights reading, I'll tell you that. But I think that's a part of the whole story. And some of us give some reasons in there. We speculate on reasons. I mean, part of it is what Ortega y Gasset, the Spanish philosopher, called this production of mass man by positivist governments, by total war governments, by modern governments. And so I think everybody in the group has probably heard of Ortega y Gasset, and those writings are still his comments are still tremendously important. Okay, let's see. I'll get off that subject now. Cam, thanks for honoring me. You see all the documents of Adam Curtis, especially by All Watch Over Buying Machines, Lord Grace. Okay, have it up. Okay. Will you check for them in the future for questions? Yes, I will. And I'm sorry, I missed a few of those questions somehow. I thought I had kept track of those, but I got sidetracked or something, and I just noticed one of Malcolm's older questions a couple of nights ago. But I'll be better about that, Malcolm. Sorry. There's some research I would like to do before posting additional questions. Yep, great. Tell us about your tours of the Western Front for students, please. Oh, well, it's almost life-changing. At our college, Austin College is a small liberal arts college, an old one, though. It's the oldest college in Texas. And We have a January term where we take students and we can travel if we want to. I mean, you don't have to, but I'm actually about to leave for a trip now to Turkey and Austria. It's called Habsburgs versus Ottomans, and we'll be in both countries. But in the World War One, I mean, also since it's in January, we hit the front when it was muddy and icy and everything else. So that was actually pretty good, but it is life changing to see all these cemeteries. We just made our way to selected spots. I mean, it would take you weeks and weeks. In fact, I had explored it first with my family. If you I don't know if I included the preface in these PDFs of my World War One book, but in the preface I do thank my family because on a sabbatical semester we did an epic trip where we slogged our way down a lot of the not nearly all of it, but a lot of the front, and saw dozens and dozens of cemeteries and battlefields and whatnot, museums. It's just overwhelming, so I recommend it. I really do. And I've done some tours with. I do a World War II tour that I've done with some families that are friends of ours in the area, and I've done some alumni tours for the college and so forth. So as it happens, I've done quite a few travel trips, and I think it's different from the classroom. You get kind of different knowledge and a different type of knowledge, but in a way a more direct knowledge of some things. I mean, if you're standing on Vimy Ridge talking about how the battle developed, then it's pretty hard to be blasé about that, you know. So let's see. Malcolm says, thanks so much, Professor Tooley, for Beto's book recommendation. As an area of research I want to look into, fraternal organizations, friendly organizations, where you see the capital and government trying to tear them apart. Yep, absolutely. Oh, he's a great guy. He's super guy. Really a cutting edge scholar who is perfectly well acquainted with all the libertarian, Misesian, Austrian kinds of approaches. Very good guy. Leslie, was the German song "Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind" written after World War One? You got me there, Leslie. You mean is that where have all the flowers gone? Is that originally a German song? I did not know that. Wow. Somebody's got to look this up. That's amazing. I did not know that. Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Yeah, it fits. That's amazing. Okay. Erica, writes, I just found a four-page Beto article, Mutual Aid to Welfare State, and that's in Mises.org. Yeah, I'd forgotten there's one in there. From Louis Maynard to everybody, libertarianismo.org. Okay, it's another bibliographical thing. I'm so glad you're swapping these things. This is wonderful. You guys are great. This is really... You know, I should have said before this, as a part of the lecture itself, I should have said that you guys have had some great questions. It's been so fun to have this little group. I mean, I know that there are people who listen to it on their own time, and you'll be listening to this now. I've corresponded with a lot of them, but it's fun to have these immediate responses too, and I really appreciate your thinking through these issues and thinking up these good questions, and I hope you take this ball and run with it and do more, as you're all suggesting that you're about to do. So that's just wonderful. I commend all of you. And once again, maybe we'll meet in some conference or other, some meeting or other sometime. That would be a lot of fun. Let's see. Oh, Pete Steger. Okay. Well, maybe they're right. Maybe they're wrong. Who knows? I mean, songs are another fun thing that we didn't get to, and I'm not going to sing any more to you in case you're reaching for your mouse to cut me off. But you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff on songs, and since we didn't get the right book PDF, since I didn't get those two chapters in, it may be in those two chapters. There's a section in there on songs and the war. A lot of songs became famous during the war, and only a very few. This is interesting. Only a very few of the state supported song mill songs, because the state just, I mean, part of the propaganda effort in all states was to get songwriters to write schlock state supporting patriotic songs. There's an American one. It's the most trivial thing you could possibly imagine. I have the sheet music because my mother found it years ago in a junk shop or an antique shop, and it's called "We're Going to Hang the Kaiser Under the Linden Tree." And for the musicians among you, if you were to see this song, is especially contemptible, because what happens is it's just a lot of little quotes from. It has a line that's like sounds like the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and then it has a line that sounds like Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then it has a line. It's just song mill stuff. It's just totally trite imitations of other songs, sticking them all together with all this verbiage about hanging Kaiser Bill under the linden tree and all that stuff. And those kinds of songs, I don't think anybody really lapped up very much. I do know that the songs soldiers sang on the front had nothing to do with the war. They had to do with individuals being cheerful. Are you down in the dumps? Then smile, smile, smile. Or they had to do with keeping the home fires burning. In other words, I'm over here, but, you know, it's like I'll be home for Christmas. I'm over here, but, in other words, that's an individual enhancing sentiment. And of course, all the songs is that, I mean, of all of them, I think the most popular in the English speaking world was certainly Mother McCree, which was sung by John McCormick and recorded, and many officers had in the rear areas, they had their phonographs and would listen to Mother McCree. People, Lily McCormick, John McCormick's wife, wrote a memoir that's fascinating. And she said that in years after the war, this is what people walked up to them every day and said, thank you for Mother McCree. So anyway, and he sang many more too. But also, It's a Long Way to Tipperary. It has absolutely nothing to do without the war. It just strikes a sentiment. There's a long, long trail of whining. These are the kinds of sentimental songs about people's, about their hopes and their dreams and their humor and their aspirations. Those are all individual things. We're going to hang the Kaiser under the linden tree. That's something else. That's something else entirely. So I think the songs are important. And there's a little section in that in my Western Front book. Okay. Do you read the diaries of the soldiers? Oh, I've read a lot of them, yeah. I mean, there's so many thousands of them, you can never read all. They're now all over the internet. They're now everywhere. I have many in my library. But, yeah, it's absolute must if you study World War I to read those diaries. And that's, you know, there's a couple of diaries on my list that I put on the forum for my top 10, which turns out to be top 14. It turns out to be not top 14, but just my favorite 14 books. But yeah, the best one of those is a book with huge emotional impact called Some Desperate Glory. But anyway, that's just a tip. Yep, you really have to read those. Okay, golly, is it 9:30 already? It's 9:30 in Texas. It must be 10:30 somewhere else. And yeah, that's right, Kathy. I mean, it makes you wonder if not only do people not have to write, but they can't write much of a letter anymore. So it's a completely different kind of record if somehow the emails even get kept. But in any case, yeah. Well, are there more questions? I don't mind. I mean, it's 9:32 to me, but you know, I have nothing else going on. I guess. I could go home and bring my dog in. My wife's out of town, so poor Adelia has to be outside. But Cam is ready to go at 4 a.m., and he'll be going that whole time without coffee, because when he says it's coffee time, then the class is over. Let me have a round of applause here for Cam Ray and his good management of this class. And, of course, we'll be getting more papers in and out, and there'll be a little bit more of this after the sort of aftermath of the course, just like there was an aftermath of the war. And so, you know, Cam, well, I suppose he'll still be on duty for all that. I hope he is, just to help people if they can't get their thing uploaded or something. But he's done a great job, and I really appreciate getting to know him through these courses. And so let's have a big round of applause for Cam. All right. So, any more questions? Would anybody like to ask one final thing? And the forum is still open. You're welcome to participate there, and I'll be checking it. I'll be better, Malcolm. Kathy asked, "What's your next course?" And that's in currently in discussions. Danny's probably sitting there waiting for me to. Waiting to hear me say, "I'm sorry I didn't write you that email yet, Danny." And well, I'll say it. "I'm sorry I didn't write you that email yet, Danny." But soon, I mean, surely after this night, I'll have more time to write the email. So the next course, we don't know yet, but maybe one of those ones I mentioned tonight. We'll see about that. They sound pretty interesting. I'm about ready to do at some point here, if the Mises Institute will allow me, to do that inflation course again, but also a course on the interwar period might be fun. I don't know. It will be something, and I think we'll know pretty soon as soon as I get around to discussing this. So I do hope to teach another one. And again, if they don't fire me. So anyway, I guess that's it, folks. To you loyal 16, I hope everybody has a good Christmas break. Thank you, Erica. Thank you, the hyperinflation one. That's really nice. You've taken 15 Mises Academy classes. That is super. That is just super. Well, Merry Christmas, everybody. I hope you have a great Christmas and a great New Year, and I hope you'll stay in touch, and maybe I'll see you on another course, or maybe at a meeting or something, and that'd be great. Cam has officially pronounced it coffee time, and so I guess we better wrap it up if he says so. So thanks again for being in the course. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you got something out of it. And see you some other time. Bye bye.